You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me my good friend, John Rubino. John is the author of several books, including The Dollar Collapse, the co-authored with James Turk. And he is a proprietor and author of many articles at dollarcollapse.com. Thanks for joining me again, John.
Hey, Jay. Well, we picked a good day to talk, didn't we?
Yeah, we sure did. It's a very interesting day. I'm looking at the NASDAQ now, down 367, Dow's down 470, and the S&P down 76. So, yeah, volatility is up. Almost everything is down. I was just saying a little bit ago that the only things I could find that's up, we see on the livestock area, almost everything, even with the exception of live cattle, which is down a little bit. You have feeder cattle, lean hogs, pork cutout, class 3 milk, non-fat dry milk, butter, and cheese. Those are all up today. And a lot of the soft commodities, cotton, coffee, sugar, lumber's not up, but then it had a tremendous run several weeks ago. And sugar is up. So the only things that seem to be up are the sort of food items. I didn't say, I saw the grains were down earlier today, but in any event, what are your comments? What are your thoughts just to get started here on today's markets? Because they really are fascinating today.
Well, I think it's really ominous what you just talked about, because those are the things that people notice. In other words, food prices are going up, right? The cost of living as it applies to regular people rather than investors is starting to really surge. Because in the past, we've had raging inflation for the past couple of decades in the U.S., but it's been narrowly focused in financial assets. Stocks, bonds, and real estate have soared. But what normal people have to pay for the things that they need to live, those things didn't really go up that much. So most people assumed that the government statistics about inflation were correct when they were actually kind of lies, because they left out the things that were going up so dramatically. But now that's shifted. You know, you go to Costco and they don't have toilet paper, and the things that you normally buy are suddenly much more expensive. And your perception of the world changes dramatically. So I think we're heading into a time when people start to assume that inflation is a real thing, and they're going to extrapolate their recent experience into the indefinite future and start acting accordingly by hoarding stuff and maybe by investing in things that are traditional inflation hedges. But just generally, it's a really bad thing because, thinking back to the last time we had this kind of an environment in the 1970s, that was a really chaotic environment. And it's not one that we want to revisit, although we seem to be revisiting it in a lot of different ways. And it's not one that's fixable using the tools of the 1970s. So this is going to be a very scary, hard to get through thing if it turns out that we are recapitulating the 1970s.
Yeah, it's really hard to see how we're not. And more and more, and I think even the Fed is now giving up the talk about transitory inflation. I'm not a real close Fed watcher, but it's my understanding that Chairman Powell is not using the word transitory in his most recent appearances before Congress. And there's more and more taper talk. And I don't know if that's to what extent taper talk is driving interest rates higher, or if interest rates are rising and they're forcing taper talk on Chairman Powell. What are your thoughts?
Are there still people left at the Fed? I thought they all got fired for insider trading.
Well, there's two of them that are resigning, I think, because of allegations of that. So, that's not a good thing. For confidence in our institutions, is it?
Oh, my God, no. Because remember, these are the guys who manage monetary policy, which in turn affects the prices of financial assets. While they were doing that, they were speculating in those same financial assets. In other words, they were loading up on stocks or bonds or whatever it was that was going to go up once the Fed made its next big announcement. So yeah, this is just the most blatant kind of insider trading, and these guys seem to be clueless about it. They just thought it was their, you know, their right as aristocrats to trade on the knowledge they have of what they're going to do to affect the market, to affect the markets next. And yeah, it feeds back into this sense that we can't trust the people in charge anymore. Yeah. Because I'll go through just a really quick list, because otherwise we'll spend the whole show just talking about why we can't trust the government and the big players anymore. But you know, this Afghanistan thing, our exit is eerily similar to our exit from Vietnam, with the same visuals and everything, and the same sense of incompetence on the part of the people who are running it. And then the pandemic. These guys, you know, speaking of the science, like it's some kind of religion, they keep changing their minds. You know, what is the science 1 month, and what you're not allowed to say on YouTube changes from month to month now. These guys have no idea what they're talking about, or that's the perception that they're giving the rest of us. And now they're starting to be really coercive. Like, you know, the U.S. government is planning to court-martial soldiers who don't want to get vaccines.
That's what I understand.
Yeah, and healthcare workers are being fired, even though, you know, these healthcare workers worked with no vaccines for a solid year, putting their own health at risk to treat people during the first part of the COVID pandemic. And now they're being told if they don't get vaccinated, they're fired. So it seems authoritarian and incompetent. And then the border thing is a huge mess, and Fed insider trading and shortages leading to inflation. All of this stuff leads to a sense on the part of a growing number of people that we cannot trust the people in charge because they're either crooked or they're incompetent or both. Mm-hmm. And remember, they're the guys running the currency. So that feeds directly back into, you know, your thesis and my thesis that we're going to have a giant currency crisis at some point. And you want to own the things that benefit from that, not the things that are hurt by it.
Well, certainly the politicians, to the extent that we're dependent on government, if they can make us dependent on government, then we'll vote for them. We'll vote for the ones that give us the most stuff, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it certainly makes, I mean, if you know, from a Democrat point of view, it certainly makes sense to open up the borders, and especially if poor people want to come here, bring them in. They're all going to need handouts. They're all going to need free this, free health care, free food, free education, free everything. And if you can have more and more voters like that, then you can really gain control, I think.
Yeah, it's in part a strategy for electoral control. But, you know, we have to remember on the inflation issue that both sides of the establishment like open borders, because Republicans like all that cheap labor coming in who can't complain about dangerous working conditions because they don't know if they're going to get deported. That's great for guys who own factories. And the Democrats love all those cheap nannies and maids and things like that, besides having voters that will tend, at least in the first generation, you know, immigrants tend to homogenize. You know, they become regular Americans after one generation normally, and you can't predict their voting patterns after that. But in that first generation, they tend to vote for the people giving them the most free stuff because they, you know, legitimately need a lot of stuff.
Sure.
And that benefits the Democrats. So, yeah, you know, you can see why immigration is such a tough issue and why the Democrats – in practice love open borders. They don't, you know, say they do, but they behave as if they do. And you know, these images of 10,000 Haitians coming over from Mexico and filling up some park under a bridge in Texas, that's not good for the Democrats, though, because it can't be chaotic. You know, if open borders are going to happen, they have to happen in an orderly way, and it is not happening in an orderly way.
Yeah.
Which is part of the incompetence thing. They can't even cheat competently, really. They mess up everything they try. Even when they're trying something that's illegitimate, they don't do it smoothly and professionally. They just can't do it.
Well, if they can keep it out of the news and keep people from knowing that that things are happening, for example, I know that the Biden administration disallowed drones from flying over that bridge to take pictures and so forth, and I guess they backed away from that after a while. But they, as soon as that became known, they got those people out of there really fast. they got those 12,000 people, whatever it was, out of there and spread them over around the United States in different places. So whatever. I just wonder, though, John, you know, these are political issues for sure. But it comes down, as you say, both Republicans and Democrats are to blame for all of this mess. And what, I mean, how are we going to pay for it? That's the question. And it's not as if we can't, we're not already insolvent, essentially, with all of the trillions of dollars of debt that we have that can never be repaid in anything like the current value of the dollar. And that's going down very rapidly. But now the Democrats are trying to push a $3.5 trillion, I think it's more of a welfare expenditure thing, through. And it's not as if Trump didn't do the same thing when he was president. So, I mean, we can't point fingers one party to the other and say that we're, you know, you're the bad ones and we're the good ones. No, it's sort of like when you can print money out of nothing. If you have that money tree from the Federal Reserve that can create with keystrokes endless amounts of money, then we'll, you know, you can understand why AOC thinks there's no limit to what we can spend money on, right? But,
yeah.
But there are limits. We know from history there are limits, and this thing can't go on forever.
Well, having an unlimited printing press has completely corrupted the political process, and by implication, the guys running the political process.
Right.
So when the Republicans get into power, they immediately enact their wish list, which is massive corporate tax cuts and a big jump in military spending. When the Democrats come into power, their wish list, which they try to push through right away, is massive social spending. And then, you know, they borrow enough money to cover it. Then they have the Fed produce enough new currency to cover the interest on the debt that they had to take on, and so on. You know, it doesn't matter who's in power. We get exactly the same thing mathematically. In other words, there's just as much currency creation under Republicans as Democrats.
Right.
And yeah, eventually it blows up the currency, you know, and that's human history. You can go all the way back to the Roman Empire to see this exact same process playing out. Only now we have technology and we're global, which is not a good thing. I think it makes the eventual crisis that much worse, but it gives us an extra decade or two in which to play these games while all the central banks of the world are acting in concert. So when this blows up, it'll blow up like nothing in history has ever blown up. But the shape of the crisis will be pretty similar to what happened, for instance, in the Roman Empire or France in the 1700s or Germany in the 1920s. It's going to look like that. It'll just be global and therefore much, much worse.
Well, if it's global right now, the dollar is still at this moment, still the world's reserve currency or the main international currency. Are we headed towards some sort of a single currency, do you think, John? Well, how do you think this is going to play out with, you know, Frank Holmes was here a couple of weeks ago talking about how the Chinese, with their digital currency, are looking to back it by gold. Alistair McLeod says, well, I don't know why they would do that. But any thoughts on how this will shake out?
Well, the idea that anybody has a coherent plan at this point is probably over-optimistic.
Uh-huh.
These guys, they've never done anything like this before. You know,
right.
No country has ever introduced a digital currency like the digital yuan or the Fed dollar or whatever they're going to call ours. So they don't really know about the unintended consequences of it. And they really just are winging it. So they're going to try lots of different things, I imagine. And none of them will work in the sense that it takes us back to a time of a healthy economy that grows organically without mountains of new debt. That's not a possibility as long as governments have control over the supply of these currencies. And when you look at the levels of control that are possible with, for instance, what China is trying to do, it's terrifying. So these new digital currencies are in reality going to be means of control. They're not going to be an improvement in monetary policy. They're going to be a way for the government to reach into your bank account and force you to obey. In other words, if you speak out against the next war that the government wants to prosecute, they can take money out of your bank account if they feel like it, or do all kinds of other things to your money with these new digital currencies. And they can track everything you do, wherever you spend. You know, it's going to be a mess.
Yeah, that seems to be the fear. And I don't think the younger people really understand this to this extent. John, I think it's those of us who have grown up brought up and have enjoyed the liberty, and we can look back and, you know, in history and look at other things, other peoples in my lifetime. I mean, I was born right after World War II, and so it was pretty fresh in everybody's memory what happened in Germany and in dictatorships around the world during the Cold War. You know, I think that the time has passed to such extent that a lot of people don't really, it's not a reality to most of the younger people. When they've lived in good times, they can't foresee the idea that they wouldn't be able to do what they want to do when they want to do it. But it's really, so John, in terms of, we only have a few minutes yet, who's going to pay for this? I mean, tax the rich is what AOC is saying. Print more money is what we all expect will happen. And that creates inflation, which then sort of pushes the cost on the middle class, I would guess. I mean, to what extent is that rich going to pay for this thing? I mean, history says the rich find ways to get out of paying.
Yeah, you can't really tax the rich. And so to the extent that anybody pays for any of this, it's going to be the people who trust the government, because it's going to be paid for via inflation, which is a stealth tax. Mm-hmm. In other words, they print a lot of money and spend it, and the money in your bank account becomes a little bit less valuable because of that new currency that was created. So your wealth shrinks while the wealth of the guys who get the money immediately from the government grows. That's how inflation works. And that's really their only tool in their own minds to get out from under this, because they can't legitimately raise taxes. They can't get away with it because both major parties are beholden to the same groups of corporations that are absolutely not going to pay 20 or 30% more in taxes. They just won't do that. They can't cut spending in order to pay for other spending, because then the people who are dependent on the spending that's going to be cut will hit the streets, and we'll have civil unrest on a scale that we haven't seen in a long time, at least since the 1960s. So there's no way to pay for any of this. They're just going to spend the money. They're going to try to inflate their way out of this debt, and eventually it will blow up on them.
John, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I want to ask you about something very interesting that you told me this morning before we went on the show about road vehicles. And you're writing an article that will be posted, I guess, either later today or tomorrow, I suppose, at dollarcollapse.com. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what you've learned about road vehicles?
Yeah, well, RVs, or recreational mm-hmm. vehicles, right. are these giant homes on wheels. And they used to be a great indicator of a market top, because that's sort of the last toy that somebody buys when they're drunk on new credit. You know, they get a motorcycle, they get a boat, big pickup truck, and then finally an RV. And that's a sign, when RVs are booming, that's a sign the market is going to tank. And then you buy an RV at the bottom of the next cycle when all these idiots have to sell them for pennies on the dollar. Well, what's happening now is something different. RVs, instead of being a toy of the idiot with yet another credit card, is that's the home of last resort for people who are on their way to homelessness. So RV sales actually boom during hard times now. So there's an RV maker called Thor Industries that is way up today, even though the rest of the stock market is tanking. Thor is up like 7 or 8% because hard times are actually great times for RVs. So that's a sign we're becoming a third world country, to put it briefly.
Wow. So people are looking to RVs as their homes.
Yes, and the more people we throw into poverty, the more RVs are demanded out there. So the more the RV makers look like good investments. It's not a good thing, you know.
It's
a true thing, yeah.
That's really interesting, John, I must say. Just maybe one more quick comment on the gold markets. Today's Agnico Eagle announcing that they will be merging with Kirkland Lake, I guess, in a friendly merger. What do you make of that?
I think this might be one of the beginning moves in what is guaranteed to be this huge wave of acquisitions in the gold industry, because the big companies are not replacing their reserves by and large, which means they're shrinking, and they've got to get new reserves from somewhere. So they're going to start buying up the littler guys, which means junior miners that have good properties are going to be very hot commodities over the next few years, and they're going to be bought out for really nice premiums over today's prices. So even in a kind of a brutal market like today's, it's good to start looking around for that relative handful of potential tier one properties out there. In other words, big properties that can move the needle for a an Agnico Eagle or a Newmont or somebody like that. And you want to own those junior mining stocks because mm-hmm. they're going to be bought out for a lot of money in the not too distant future.
You know, there's certainly a number of them that I think have that chance, John, and I know you and I talk about them from time to time. I did talk to Chris Taylor yesterday, and he indicated that he thinks, how did he put it, the foxes are circling the wagon or something like that. In other words, he said that yesterday before the announcement was coming out, that and he's concerned, of course, that Great Bear could be taken over too cheaply. He's really hoping to stave off these predators until at least after he gets to do his initial resource, and expected to be actually more than a 5 million ounce per ton resource. And he told me, he says, if you know of any other company that's maiden resource was in excess of 5 million ounces, tell me, because I've never heard of one. So Great Bear is one I think is going to be a target. I don't know how much it will sell over its current price, but of course Chris is trying to hold them off as long as he can. Well, my engineer is telling me it's all over. Taylor, you've got to quiet down and leave the show for the next show coming on. So, John, thank you so much for being with us again, and we'll look to do it again sometime soon. So,
thanks, Jay.
All right, folks. Well, next week, Michael Hudson of Hannon Metals and Frank Holmes of U.S. Global will be with me. Frank will talk about cryptocurrencies, gold, and gold shares. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Labrador Gold is an exploration company focused on its flagship Kingsway project, located in central Newfoundland Gold District. Labrador Gold's first phase drilling program has successfully identified high-grade gold mineralization, including a 3.6-meter intercept, grading 20.6 grams per ton gold, and 1.85 meters, grading 50.38 gram per ton gold. The company has approximately $35 million in the treasury and is led by a world-class team of CEO Roger Moss and technical advisors Sean Ryan and Quentin Henney.